Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Before we start the show today, I have to talk to you about something. It's actually a little embarrassing, but if we make it through this, I think we're all going to be better off. So, in the last show with Jay Dyer, I did a fake ad for a company called Red Napkin. This was an effort to, raise money for the show. And when you do a fake ad, it's kind of like you're making a commitment to not have advertisers on your podcast, to keep this show listener supported. It's a model we've been, fairly successful with through the years. By the way, Red Napkin, I know a lot of people went to the website. It is, in fact, a restaurant in the UK exclusively for gay men. So I'm sorry if that resulted in any misadventures for any of you. But yeah, not a real company. It was a parody of Blue Apron, which is a pretty regular sponsor on a lot of the bigger podcasts. So anyway, I make this commitment to not have ads in an effort to raise money. Not a lot of response from that. And then I guess kind of ironically, over the past week, I've discovered a company I really actually want to have a relationship with because it really actually connected with me. And they have a product and a service that perfectly fulfills a need that I have, and I never knew what it would take to do that until I saw what they were offering. So I want to talk to you about it for a couple minutes. And again, like I said, it's a little embarrassing to do a 180 like that just from one episode to the next, but I really think this is important. Most of you know that I move around a lot. In fact, since I've graduated from college, the longest I've lived in any one place, I think, is about 3 years. So I'm very transient. And when you move around a lot, it's like, you find a nice place that you want to live, you like the town, you bring all your things in there. But there's a subtle, ephemeral feeling about the place while you're there. It's like missing something that makes it home. And I know I'm not the only person who struggled with this. The economy has changed. Our parents' generation could certainly expect to hold down, one job for 30 years and retire. But today, lots of us are switching jobs every 3 or 4 years. That often means relocation and also means maybe never really feeling at home, So what does it take to feel at home is the question that I've always asked myself, as for many years I felt like kind of a guest in my own house. The answer, which I discovered just days ago, really surprised me. That it's something very simple, located for most people in their kitchen. The one overlooked thing that makes us feel at home, folks, a nice stuffed junk drawer. Steve, fire it up. But how do you deliberately build a junk drawer? You can't force a junk drawer. A good junk drawer takes years to amass, you protest. Well, not anymore. Now there's a solution from the innovative folks who brought you both Loot Crate and Trunk Club comes Shitbox. Every month, the folks at Shitbox will send you a package chocked full of items that you can't initially imagine a use for, but for some reason, you'd feel very apprehensive about throwing away. Items you need to build a really natural and organic feeling junk drawer. I just got my first shipment here. Let's open her up. Let's see. Ooh, a tennis ball. Now, I don't play tennis, but who knows? I might want to bounce this ball someday, so we'll hold on to that. Hey, Steve, can you cut the music so people can really get the shitbox experience here? Thanks. All right. Ooh. Looks like we got about a third of a roll of scotch tape. We're going to want to hang on to that because eventually there will be birthday or Christmas presents to wrap. Two pens. Two pens. This one doesn't work. This one kind of works. Hey, if you're getting a little restless waiting for the show to start, you can go to patreon.com/schoolsucks and sign up to support us. It's about a $5 or $6 monthly commitment. You'll get access to lots of bonus shows. Sorry, just got to get through these ads here. Ooh, a business card of a guy I might have met who has a service that I could possibly need one day. So hold on to that. This is without a doubt trash. Ooh, all right, let the fun begin. A cigarette lighter. That works! Perfect. Well, it's good if the power goes out. And you probably hear that jingling. Every shitbox comes with 9 pennies and 6 assorted nails. It's because the designers at Shitbox know that any good junk drawer needs a really solid base of metallic objects. So every month you're going to get the 9 pennies and the 6 nails. They're always at the bottom. We got a 9-volt battery and, ooh, a key! What does it go to? Maybe one day we'll find out. So that's it, folks. Shitbox.biz. It is time for all of us to feel at home wherever we go. And I'm just going to use this pen that kind of works. SchoolSucksProject.com/A. Oh, I tore through the box. AV. Or I'm also going to write Patreon.com/ School sucks. Please stay tuned to after the show. I've got some more announcements and stuff to talk to you about. It's been a frustrating and at times frightening couple of months, socially, politically, technologically, but I brought a couple of pals on the show today to see if we can make some fucking lemonade. Here we go. So I'm very pleased to welcome back to School Sucks, Nathan Frazier. Hey, Nathan.
Hey, Brett. Thanks for inviting me on the show again.
My pleasure. And Drew Sample. Hey, Drew.
Hey, Brett. Thanks for having me on.
So first, some introductions. Drew is an urban farmer, entrepreneur, and host of the Sample Hour podcast. He first appeared on School Sucks October 17th, 2014. And Nathan is an entrepreneur who puts his expertise in copywriting and marketing to work for many others every day. He's the creator of a platform and service called Podcast Blastoff, which is, dare I say, a kind of all-in-one solution to podcasting, as all-in-one a solution to podcasting can be. He's also the host of the Nathan Frazier Show. He first appeared on School Sucks podcast April 15th, 2012. And both Drew and Nathan have been back on the show several times since then. They both participated in the series that I did January 2016 on productivity. Drew and I did a show on Evernote. Nathan and I did a couple of shows on setting goals. And then we all teamed up for the last show in the series, which was on the Mastermind group, which all three of us still participate in together. So did I leave anything out, or does anybody want to expand on any part of the brief bios that I gave?
No, man, I sounded pretty cool the way you described me.
Yep, same here.
So our topic for the day is the internet and how it is both connecting us and dividing us. We're going to talk some about the opportunities this medium creates. But it's also really important, I think this is going to be the focus of our conversation, the echo chamber effect and how that creates so much of the division in society that we're witnessing, really accelerating so significantly just over the last year. But this is a problem that we've been talking about on School Sucks all the way back to 2014. I think we first broached this topic around the time of Sandy Hook. Before we get to that, I wanted to spend a little bit of time discussing the first in-person engagement, actually, the three of us are going to have this November 10th through the 12th. Both Nathan and Drew are going to attend Renegade University and School Sucks Project Present a Weekend with Thaddeus Russell in Los Angeles, California. I'm leaving in just 11 days to start my trek across the country to arrive in Los Angeles on November 9th. But, you know, Drew is in Columbus, Ohio. Nathan is out in Colorado. So they have treks to make as well to this event in Los Angeles. And I just wanted to hear from each of you guys why you decided to do this. It's, you know, a big commitment, not just in time, but it's a significant expense. So I wanted to just get your thoughts. Drew, how about you?
one of the biggest reasons why, when you told us about the first event, it was something I really wanted to go to, but I was in the middle of my season with farming, and it was my first year farming, so I was like, you know what, I'll go to the next one. And when I heard that podcast with the live one, I just kind of felt moved. I remember once I heard it, I sent a message in the group thread saying, you know, we all need to be there. Like, we all need to meet. Like, we've been friends via the internet for, I don't know. I mean, we've all been, I mean, I've talked to both of you, I think, since 2013, 2014. I've met Nathan in person, but I haven't met you in person, Brett. And something really special always happens when we develop these relationships through via the internet. And then we come together in the flesh space. I don't want to say real life because the internet's real life too, but in the physical world, I think it's going to be just something that's really powerful. I think it's every time I put myself out there and meet people, whether it was creating comedy show meetups or going to the Jackalope Freedom Festival or when I went to Permaculture Voices, it's always helped me build close relationships, and it's always changed my life for the better. I think for me, it's always about not necessarily who's in front of the room, but it's also like who, you know, turning my head and seeing, okay, who am I sitting next to? What are these people's stories? Who are these people? So I think the only reason I'm making my urban farming run work right now is because I have a guy that I could, he's my contractor, and I trade him housing for labor. And I met him at an event, and like I met him in San Diego at Permaculture Voices. And then he started listening to my show. And then him and I started like talking more. We hung out at the event, but we started talking more, became friends, and then decided it would be a good idea for this to happen.
Awesome. Nathan, how about you?
Everything that Drew said, plus I was already planning to go out to California. My family's in California. I grew up out there, and I was already planning to make a trip out this winter.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like Drew said, listening to that last podcast, I was like, oh man, I got the fear of missing out. I felt like I totally missed out on the opportunity for that last podcast. When I listened to it, I was kicking myself in the butt for not attending the first time that you and Thad got together. And
yeah.
Then when you brought it up in the mastermind, you said that you were going to be doing another one. And since it is in my hometown of LA, and also a chance, it's a chance to catch up with family, and it's a chance to meet with one of my clients, David Garfinkel. So he's going to be there as well. It was just an opportunity I couldn't pass up on. That's why.
Cool. Perhaps a question that could generate some controversy here. And I agree with what you guys are saying about making these connections. A huge part of the event was social. And that was really what impacted me, was just being able to, you know, sit across the table from people at lunch and hear their stories and walk around and sightsee. Knowing that we have a foundation of mutual respect and mutual interest and somewhat not identical, but even similar worldviews. But I'm wondering if there's something that you guys wanted to get out of it as far as ideas were concerned. Obviously, Thad is the star of the event, and he has some ideas that are very controversial within the School Sucks community. So I don't know if either of you guys had plans to mix it up, or, you know, I really wanted people to debate with him about certain topics, or if there was just something that you wanted to hear expanded upon based on, you know, like what's happening in the world right now. How about you, Drew?
It's tough. Like, I like a lot of what Thad has to say, than other times, you know, I don't. I think, I mean, ultimately, if a conversation happens or something said, I don't think I'm going to hesitate to voice what my thoughts are. And I think that's what's kind of exciting about the event. I mean, there's definitely a lot of stuff going on in the real world that I could go down rabbit holes. Maybe getting him to talk more about something he said about the 9/11 thing, if the politics make a lot of sense there, but then it's just the plausibility thing. So I don't know, maybe talk more about that stuff.
Absolutely. I really want to, I don't know what it is, but I really want to get that 9/11 discussion going. I know Nathan can be helpful with that too. And same question to you, Nathan, anything as far as like ideas or exchange of ideas you're aiming for at this event?
So at the risk of being offensive,
yeah,
the first time I ever heard of Thaddeus Russell was on your podcast, and I despised him. Like, I remember the first appearance. I went through and listened to it again just to hate, like, just to, like, rage listen.
Do you remember what episode it was or what we were talking about?
I don't, but I remember the concept of his ideas and his views of property rights just totally infuriated me.
Right.
And being that I grew up on welfare, being that I grew up with disrespect of private property, and how much that mentality held me back for the first part of my life, how much not understanding how important private property and property rights are, how much of my potential was basically killed because I fought against private property. Hearing a lot of the stuff that he was bringing up in those first couple appearances on your show, particularly pertaining to private property, just infuriated me because it reminded me of like the 16-year-old version of me saying all the stupid stuff that current version of me would slap the shit out of myself for saying.
Right, right.
So I thought Thad is this brilliant guy and he makes so much sense. And then when it came to those one, to that one or maybe two other issues, he just really got under my skin. And it seems like he's kind of made a transition, though. It seems like maybe he's not as dogmatic about it and he's starting to see maybe the world from a different pair of shoes. I think because he's now venturing off into the world of entrepreneurialism, he's venturing out into the private sector and a little bit away from academia. I think that maybe his worldview has a different lens that he's able to see it with now.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's, if I have the opportunity, that's what I want to speak with him about.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think you're absolutely right that his views on that particular subject have been tempered over the last few years, partially probably because of his exposure to the people at Reason. I know he's done his own research going in Mises literature. And, you know, that was one of the things that I found more attractive about him in recent times is that you could see that there had been an evolution in his thinking, which is extremely rare for somebody who has that kind of academic background. But when we teamed up last year to do a series of shows about academic conformism, and he talked about, you know, how much his views have changed just through observations of the world in the last couple of years, you know, I said, we got to be doing more together because this is not only rare, but it's really exciting and it has the potential to generate tons of interesting conversation. So yeah, it will be neat to see what happens and how he might take a contrarian position on the property rights thing, just for the sake of being able to have the discussion about it.
And this is probably going to maybe segue into what we're going to be talking about today. But one thing about your show, specifically the ones where he has been on, is the fact that you both have these different sets of values, a little bit of overlap, a little bit of separation. You both have different points of view and you both respect each other. And when Thad came on, and even when I was just like yelling at the tablet listening to those episodes, you both showed each other a tremendous amount of respect for your differing points of view. And that's something that, you know, it just doesn't seem to be very common in the atmosphere nowadays.
No, I like the idea of trying to model that. Unfortunately, as the world around us becomes more, it seemed like we had a luxury a few years ago that we don't have anymore, where it's kind of like, you know, we're back to back now with our swords out, sort of defending against what's encroaching on us, when the world was quieter a couple years ago and there was more space for people who think similarly in a lot of ways to find those points of disagreement. It is almost like the social conditions and the political conditions of the world have created this team mentality. You're discovering alliances that at one time you would have been very surprised to have.
Yeah, I definitely. I think for me, traditionally, I mean, I came from very far left. I mean, my parents are very, very, they were very political. They were very Democrat. So I never expected to be considered alt-right or be thrown in with them because I enjoy trolling or something like that. Or I think that, you know, our whole system's kind of satirical in general. Mm. So I think, like, cause everything's funny to me. Like me and Nathan will have conversations and I just kind of make fun of it. And Nathan came here and we went to the Milo event together and it was kind of funny to hear. It was like, oh man, these guys are, I kind of feel like these guys are where I was, like, when, you know, back when I first started reading books. I never thought people would throw the word racist at me or call me a Nazi sympathizer just for having a difference of opinion. Mm-hmm. And so I think for me, like somebody who came from like a far left family, I mean, yeah, I never thought I'd be considered a conservative, and I don't even consider myself conservative today.
Sure. Yeah. Nathan, have you been called these names? Nazi sympathizer or racist?
I personally haven't, but I do see that the term is just thrown around way too loosely nowadays, kind of like rape culture. And I will say, though, like both of you probably, I definitely grew up on the left end of the whole spectrum. And I wouldn't say that I've moved over to the right. I'm definitely more of a centrist in most of my points of view. But I find, even in like the libertarian community, I find a lot of the leftist and a lot of the social justice warrior mentality pushing me away from those people. And there's a lot of people that I used to look up to. There's a lot of people that I used to have good relationships with inside of the libertarian community that have seemed to have gone more left and have pushed me and my values away. So maybe not so much finding strange alliances, because I definitely haven't been pushed into the opposite camp. I definitely still disagree with a lot of the alt-right stuff. I disagree with a lot of the authoritarian right position still. I haven't like swung the opposite way as the pendulum might do, but I've definitely been alienated from the left libertarians because I feel like they've just gone just as far off the deep end as the alt-right has. So it's kind of weird to be in a position where nowadays I can't really tell who I hate more or who I am frustrated more with. The absolute blind faith in authoritarian, we must support our president no matter what, or the right. Not my president crowd. I've always fallen into the not my president crowd, but nowadays those people have become as alien to me as the blind obedience people have. So it's a weird spot to be in.
Yeah, and it takes a situation like what we've seen play out in the last couple of weeks with the NFL that really provides, for me anyway, a kind of wake up, because I felt myself drifting more into sympathies with the right, just sort of unconsciously, you know, like the Ben Shapiro, Steven Crowder crowd. Like, I'm just sort of implicitly on their side about most social and political issues. But then you see this flag controversy, the national anthem controversy in the NFL, and it's like, oh, the other side is capable of being just as stupid when they are triggered. And there's just the situation where, again, there is no protagonist. Today on the show, we are going to be exploring the reasons why this problem has become so palpable in the last couple of years. I wanted to start with a little bit of backstory. I've said several times on my show that in this technological age, this medium of the internet, and I know this sounds very dramatic, but I see the possibility of it splitting humanity basically into two very clear groups, even more than they were split before. And I think a way to organize them is producers and consumers. The producers are the people who will be able to harness this technology, like Nathan, you have certainly done, like Drew has done, like I like to think I have done, to create something, to put our own voice out into the world. But there's this other side of people who are sort of unconscious consumers of all of the things that the internet provides, which is everything from news to pornography to outright distraction. Now, instead of taking this tone of elitism, I also think, you know, that divide exists in most individuals as well. You know, I feel the impulses to go the consumption route a lot of the time, especially when there's a challenging production problem in front of me. I might procrastinate by switching into mindless consumer mode.
I think it's interesting, man. I think just the whole business design of most of the internet is reactionary. So I mean, it's they're banking on us to react, to make money, especially Facebook. So I don't know about you guys, but I think we've all talked about taking breaks from Facebook, or I only look at my alerts anymore for the most part, because I don't want to get upset about something, or I don't want to just start. I mean, because usually what happens is I just end up trolling people, and then it's counterproductive. It's something I'm trying to get away from, because I don't want to just constantly upset people, because I don't think it's necessarily as good as for my brand as a human being as I'd want it to be, even though I think it's funny or I find it entertaining. But the internet is a tool just like anything else, and that you can, I mean, the way I've always described Facebook is you can either use it to stalk ex-girlfriends or ex-boyfriends, or think about maybe how much better you are, find reasons why you're better than other people you went to high school with, or you can use it as a tool to meet people or find like-minded individuals. It's up to us as individuals to cultivate it. I mean, like I met both you guys through Facebook. I got both you guys on my show via Facebook. So, I mean, you know, it's a good tool, but at the same time, know what that tool is. Know, you know, when you upload photos that, you know, Facebook owns the right to those photos now. So, you know, be aware of what this tool can do and how it can be used.
Absolutely. Nathan, do you feel that split between producer and consumer in yourself?
I think all of us have. I mean, if your life is just 100% production, you're going to go insane.
Right.
If your life is 100% consumerism, you're going to be the average American. I mean, I have a Netflix account and I watch stuff on Netflix periodically. I listen to a lot of YouTube videos. I guess the balancing act, a lot of times, even inside like the entrepreneurial world, you can just become obsessed with consuming information. And I bet you there's probably people listening to this right now that are definitely addicts of information products or addicts of information podcasts. I know that one of the things that I had to do at a particular point was I had to say, okay, I've learned enough. I need to start implementing some of this stuff, especially when I was first starting out researching marketing and business structures and copywriting and all of that stuff. I spent months and months and months just absorbing everything I could find about it, consuming. It was educational consumption, but it was still consuming. And at one point I said, okay, I need to start acting on this because I've learned as much as I can learn without actually implementing. So even the most productive people, I think, have to find a balance between consuming and producing. And I think that, unfortunately, I don't want to say this as a negative against capitalism, but because capitalism has provided such a high standard of living and we don't really struggle in a way that previous generations have, we don't really struggle in a way that third world countries do, we have the luxury to either spend our time thinking about stuff and having these great philosophical conversations, or we have the luxury of just mindlessly consuming all kinds of entertainment. And a lot of people, because, you know, they have electricity, they have indoor plumbing, they don't need to go hunting or they don't have to plant their own food. So they have all this extra free time. They spend it just consuming. Maybe it's educational. Maybe it's just pure entertainment. It's there and it can be used to lift yourself up. But if you don't do it consciously, it can definitely pull you down. And I think all of us struggle with that.
Sure. I think there's a real clear distinction between active and passive consumption. Like there is some consumption that I try not to beat myself up about it, but sometimes I actually feel bad. Like, oh my God, I just wasted an hour consuming, you know, some form of entertainment that was just pure distraction. I mean, at the end of the day, it's different. I have a Netflix account and the Amazon Prime account, and I'm glad I have them and I get a lot of enjoyment from them. And I think they're an important part of a balanced lifestyle. I mean, that's entertainment. I think there's also a kind of procrastination in consumption that you talked about, where I will tell myself a story that I need to be consuming this instead of actually working on the production side of things. Like, we all understand that active consumption is about generating the raw materials that we need often, whether they're, you know, ideas or knowledge to do production. But a lot of times I feel like I'm just telling myself a little bit of a story, like I should really watch this YouTube video because I could use it in this thing that I'm vaguely planning at some undetermined time in the future, or just engaging with media, especially on YouTube, with which I disagree, to kind of get my gears turning a little bit. I spend a lot of time doing that as well. But if it doesn't turn into, you know, something that is produced, I question the value of that as far as, you know, time management. Yeah, I think there is this real challenge. The more I was thinking about this subject, I saw a lot of tie-ins to the Speed in Politics series that I did and the book Thinking Fast and Slow. When it comes to consuming information or the passive consumption of information, there's another book that I'm actually just recording a bonus show about called The Art of Thinking Clearly. It's almost like a Cliff's Notes version of Thinking Fast and Slow. And, you know, one of the things that it talks about is this word that we use several times on the show during that series, heuristics. these sort of mental shortcuts people take because they're biologically driven to take such shortcuts a lot of the time. When we think about collectivism or people being followers, there's a survival impulse that leads to people doing that, obviously. Like, you know, 100,000 years ago, if you were in a group of humans and everybody in the group started sprinting, that's an indication that you should sprint as well, probably, right? Or your food if you don't. So do blindly and mindlessly what the rest of the group does for the sake of survival. And in this digital age, we're seeing a lot of these biologically driven impulses in a world that humans are just not prepared in many cases, because where would we have gotten the training to live in, to thrive in? And, you know, people are having more thrown at their brains than ever before. And the only way that people can engage with all of this input is through taking mental shortcuts. And, you know, what a lot of the studies are finding, I mean, the debate on, you know, like Facebook and echo chambers and insularity within social or political groups is it's really like, is it a technological problem or is it a human problem? And I think there's arguments to be made for both sides, but there are some really sort of innate human shortcomings when it comes to living in this world that creates a lot of these problems around, you know, the information consumption and being able to process and really sort of deal with all this information with any kind of serenity.
So as a marketer, one of the very first lessons that you learn is that you have to enter the conversation that's already going on in your prospect's mind. It goes into like cognitive dissonance. It goes into confirmation bias, the way that people tick. But as somebody who's trying to reach other people, you don't want to slap people in the face as your introduction. You want to give them overlap. You want to show them where your two worldviews, your two maps have a similar overlay before you start trying to take them down a different road. As human beings, when somebody tells us we're wrong, instead of listening, we often tend to dig our heels in. So if somebody wants to persuade us, they need to first tell us where they agree with us. And then, you know, we put our defenses down and we're more likely to listen to the other point of view at that point. In when it comes to like things like social media, and you were saying like the echo chambers and the way that this breaking up into different camps and, you know, people seeing themselves as Jesus Christ and anybody who disagrees with them is literally Hitler. A lot of that comes down to the fact that when it comes to like YouTube or when it comes to Facebook, these businesses understand psychology. They understand that if you're constantly hit with opposing points of view when you log into their service, if you're constantly hit with cognitive dissonance, if you're constantly hit with things that make you question your reality, you're not going to spend very much time there. So it's in their best interest to take the things that you interact with the most, to take the things that most conform to what you want to experience, to what, and it's us, it's our fault. It's as human beings, we tend to favor things that make us feel right. We tend to favor things that make us feel superior. We tend to favor things that make us feel justified, vindicated. So we gravitate towards that stuff. So Facebook knows if we want to have people on our platform, we need to provide that type of feeling. We need to provide that sense of superiority. We need to provide that confirming of belief systems for our people when they come here. That's how they keep us there. That's how YouTube keeps you there. That's why algorithms are so important. That's why. So as a business person, I understand why they do it. As somebody who studies psychology, I understand why we're attracted to that. But like we were talking about when we were first starting the show, talking about your episodes with Thad, when you had Brian and Stephanie on, the fact that even though I vehemently disagreed with a lot of the stuff and I agreed with some of the other stuff, the fact that you're willing to have those conversations is something that most people don't want to have, don't want to listen to. And as a consumption provider, as somebody who's providing something for consumers, we want to make sure that we're not turning people away from what we provide by making them face uncomfortable opposing opinions. And so it's one of those things like, do we blame them for catering to the way that we act, or do we point the finger at ourselves and say, maybe we should change? And it seems like with the exception of like even inside of the Liberty community where there used to be a big amount of unity, like, yeah, we might disagree about polyamorous relationships, or we might disagree about the nuclear family, but we all come together on liberty. It seems even inside of the Liberty community, there's been this huge division now of people just not willing to see things from the other point, the other person's point of view. And to be really about liberty, you have to have empathy. You have to have understanding that what works for you might not work for other people. But for me, I don't have a family, but I think that families are important. I feel like especially not having a family, it's one of the things that I really wish I did have in my life, because I feel like it's important to have family members. I think it's important to have a stable family structure, especially as a kid growing up. There's other people inside of the Liberty community that are like, oh, that the nuclear family is just outdated and it's a stupid idea. Maybe it's a stupid idea for you, but it's not a stupid idea for the people that it works for. So on both sides, people have, especially where we're supposed to be about, hey, I'm going to live my life the way I live my life, and I'm going to respect that you're going to live your life differently. And that's like the foundation of what liberty is all about. But we have a lot of people that are like, I don't like the nuclear family. Therefore, it's a dumb idea. And anybody who follows it is just a relic and deserves to be dead with the history books. And then on the other side, no, the nuclear family is the only way, and homosexuals shouldn't be allowed to adopt kids and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, it's just, is it our media to blame, or is it us to blame and our media is just catering to the way that we are?
It's interesting, and I'm going to throw to Drew in a minute. You laid out a lot of stuff there, and I have lots of opportunities for comment, and I want to hear what Drew has to say. I'll just add this right now. I said earlier in the conversation that Thad and I had all these areas of disagreement, but in the last couple of years, the political and social conditions have kind of put us back to back with our swords out in this defensive position against a lot of what's happening with academia and with the authoritarian left. I think in libertarianism or in the liberty movement, a lot of us started out in that position with, you know, all our backs together and our swords facing out, because it was freedom versus the state and statism. And as the conversation, I mean, so that goes back, you know, 6-7 years when the internet was very, very different, and interactions on the internet were very, very different than they are today. And as we all stood there with our backs together and our swords out, the conversation expanded. There was more room for more debate as the medium evolved. And eventually we kind of started looking at each other and saying, well, wait a minute, you know, we're together in this fight, but there's all these other fights that we could be having. And I think like the platform, especially Facebook, sort of caters to those fights taking place and almost encourages them because of the communication style it fosters. But we can talk a little bit about that more in a minute. Drew, anything you want to add to what Nathan said?
Yeah, the one sentence persuasion is what Nathan was talking about. So people, this is from Blair Warren. There's a free book on Kindle, but people will do anything for those who encourage their dreams, justify their failures, allay their fears, confirm their suspicions, and help them throw rocks at their enemies. And that's what, I mean, Facebook is kind of designed to do so they can make money, just what like Nathan was saying. So I've talked to both you guys about this privately. Is like a big issue, I think, with the internet is it's mainly communication. I think, you know, something to kind of touch on what Nathan was saying, like it is really nice to hear your show, Brett, because you get people that you don't necessarily agree with, but you keep it like a civil discussion. So I think I don't really like the term debate, mainly because I think debate has kind of gotten out of hand with like it's just like a money making scheme now with Bill Nye versus some born like some flat earther or creationist or just like Bill O'Reilly and John Stewart trying to make a bunch of money and not really even having a debate or a disagreement. So I think when people hear real civil conversations, it helps us remember how we are supposed to communicate with one another. And I think ultimately, like my biggest beef with social media or trying to have a civil conversation on social media is that, I mean, I'm trying to remember. So I was in sales for like 10 years before, you know, I went off on my own, and 60% of our communication is via body language. And I think I forget the next higher percentage is our voice inflection, how we are saying our words. And then like the littlest amount is our actual words. And so when you remove most of our communication and you put in just words, it's easy for people to get triggered if you're trying to have a conversation. And I think that's, I mean, so I personally try to use emojis to let somebody know I'm just having fun or I'm just doing that. But even then, I think it's a new form of communication for us. So I think that's,
yeah,
we're in like a juvenile stage with this form of communication, so people act very juvenile. For like the broader picture of liberty being divided, it felt like the big divide started in liberty, and then I felt like it trickled out the rest of the way. Like it felt like
interesting.
The first time I ever heard anybody call Trump a fascist was Jeffrey Tucker on
that's right, yeah,
our friend Chris Stefanik's show, and then it became a big thing. So I feel like a lot of things start with us and then they trickle out. I don't know why. I think we're kind of hipper to different things, maybe. And I think because, you know, just like Jonathan Haidt talks about, typically people in liberty are more system thinkers. So, and I think a lot of times system thinkers are a little bit ahead of the curve in markets, but I don't have any research to back that up. It's purely anecdotal or what I've observed.
Well, I agree. I've had a lot of the same observations, and it's like there's a lot of issues or a lot of language that by the time it reaches the mainstream, it almost seems trite because people inside the liberty community have been talking about it for years, especially if it relates to some, you know, political or economic issue. It doesn't seem like anything new. So with a conspiratorial worldview of how people's opinions are shaped, it's hard to think about the liberty movement as being, you know, trend-setting in any way. But you're right that a lot of these conversations do seem to start here. I think there's something about people who are attracted to these ideas who also have that willingness to mix it up with other people, which means that there's a higher probability of them being exposed to new ideas, which is kind of a, you know, a segue into our next topic here. One of the things that Nathan suggested, and I wanted to reiterate, first of all, something that has bothered me a little bit is I see people setting up a kind of conspiracy narrative when it comes to Facebook, right? Facebook is blamed for basically working like a news editor, favoring, you know, liberal content or left-wing content over conservative or libertarian content. And Nathan spoke to Facebook, it is running a business. They're also aware enough of human psychology that they're feeding people what they want. And this, you know, lines up with the heuristics comments that I was making a little while back. People want those shortcuts to organize and make meaning in the world. And Facebook has an algorithm that will provide them. But people have set up this conspiracy narrative about Facebook that just leads to internalizing powerlessness. Well, I'll never get my message out. These ideas will never become popular because Facebook only pushes, you know, like the Hillary Clinton news. Now, I want to separate this from Facebook's ban policies or suspension policies, which do seem more targeted politically. But as far as the content that Facebook delivers, it's interesting. I've looked at studies and people on the left are actually seeing more contradictory content than people on the right are seeing in their news feeds. How they filter that content personally is a different story, but I just want to make sure that we're not blaming Facebook for having a business model that is responsive to whether, you know, it's healthy or not, what human needs and desires are. One of the things that I perked up to as far as the danger here was concerned was we talk a lot about parenting on my show and the danger of overprotective parenting and, you know, shows I've done with people like Dana Martin or Lenore Skenazy, these hover bubble wrap parents and how that actually winds up hurting children because it doesn't prepare them for the world. And I think that, you know, too much of the internet for too many people has become like these parents with Purell. If you understand that metaphor, like the big diseases of the 20th century, in some cases, they actually wound up affecting wealthy people more than they affected poor people, simply because the wealthy people hadn't been out in the dirt and, you know, in unclean situations, which would allow them to build up immunity. They had no exposure to these germs, and therefore the diseases were more devastating in certain populations. The same is true with ideas. You know, ideas and speech, we see how emotionally devastating they can be for people who've never engaged with them and been forced to intellectually defend against them. So, I mean, public school is part of the problem. Higher education is certainly part of the problem. But Facebook and Google and YouTube are all reinforcements for this that continue beyond school, right? People are getting, you know, content curated by these algorithms. Part of it is Facebook, but part of it, like the really significant part of it, is what human beings want based on the shortcuts they need to take to feel comfortable engaging with these ideas.
So that's one of the things that I think has really changed and really sets me against the whole SJW mentality is when I first got onto the internet, I would say at that point, I was very much hardcore leftist. And getting onto the internet exposed me to a whole bunch of ideas that made me very uncomfortable, made me question the way I was taught, the things that I was taught to believe. And I realized that there's this broad conversation going on that I had only been picking up maybe 1% or a fraction of 1% of the whole conversation that was out there. And when I first discovered the internet, I was able to go and find all these different ideas. And some of them were, you know, reptilian lizard people from the hollow earth. And some of them were Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. So you got to pick and choose. But some of these ideas broadened my ability to think, made me able to see the world from a different point of view. Like I said, made me able to, a lot of the things that I was stuck in, I was definitely stuck in the victimhood mentality. I'm poor because other people are rich. I'm oppressed because other people have more money than me. Corporations are 100% evil. There's no such thing as a good businessman. When one person gains something, another person has to lose. It's a fixed pie. All of these economic ideas that I had, when I found the internet, I was able to start looking at other points of view. I was able to start seeing the world through other people, you know, practicing empathy because I was able to explore other people's ideas. Nowadays, though, we're seeing this push on the internet to restrict that again. We're seeing people saying, you can't have these opinions. You can't say this. Your website will get taken down. Your YouTube channel will get demonetized. We'll deplatform you or no platform. We're seeing, I don't know if either of you guys follow like what's going on with Marvel Comics lately, but they've just completely stripped out anything that's right of Karl Marx has been labeled not appropriate for Marvel Comics. And for me, a comic book fan growing up, it kind of irritates me that there's not this diversity of thought anymore. And we're seeing a lot of this SJW mentality in the internet where it used to provide, and it still does, but this vast amount of exploration of ideas, people are maybe coming out of college, entering into these tech industries, and a lot of these tech industries, a lot of the entertainment industries are going the opposite way. When I found the internet, I was so grateful to find opinions that made me uncomfortable, and now it seems like the major push is to kind of try and shove the genie back into the bottle and get rid of ideas that make people uncomfortable, which is scary to me.
Right. Like, because I've really tried to understand this phenomena that we've seen in terms of like the 2016 psychological meltdown of the left seemingly as a whole and the subsequent Trump derangement syndrome, especially after the election, when all of these things that you're talking about, I mean, we would agree they've intensified since then, right?
Yeah.
I haven't really talked about it on the show yet, but I've tried to understand to find some kind of compassionate understanding for what has happened here. As far as we just split people into to the left and right and kind of separate libertarianism out of this, or, you know, liberty-minded people who are also usually very tech-minded, the left was kind of first to embrace this technology. They were the first to embrace this medium because it's mostly composed of younger people. It also, you know, the resources of higher education provided people a faster path to the technological world. And the first time we really saw the internet used politically successfully, I mean, it's been used for decades at this point, but the greatest success so far of the 21st century politically, at least before Trump, was probably Obama's 2008 presidential campaign, right? Where they harnessed the internet to win. And it seems like since then, the left's attitude has been that the internet exists for the purpose of political mobilization, and most other things are a distraction. And if you look at the way that, you know, feminism or Black Lives Matter, how they interact on Twitter and how they use Twitter, it's like Black Lives Matter has said, you know, what we're doing online is not about making a convincing case for white people. It's about creating solidarity for Black people. And I think that the internet is simply amplifying what the left's impulses have been for a century, to organize and regiment people towards some kind of political or economic purpose. So we might be there to exchange ideas, which for many of us is just code for win debates, right? Right. And I mean, after, like, you know, the things we grew up seeing, like, we know how cool it looks to win a debate based on watching, like, Stefan Molyneux debate people, or, you know, a lot of us were also sympathetic to some of the viewpoints of somebody like Christopher Hitchens, who would just slaughter people in debates over and over and over again. It looks cool to do this. The later version of this would be Ben Shapiro. So there's a lot of people now on the right who are all about free speech and open exchange of ideas because of the model Ben Shapiro provides, started with his demolition of Piers Morgan on the gun thing 4 or so years ago. And people, they like that. They want to see more of that, but they know that doesn't come from the left. I think, like the left, most conservatives don't feel like there's actually anything to debate. You know, Ben Shapiro is kind of an exception. People are so neatly and clearly divided into the categories of good and evil, and the internet echo chambers reinforce that idea every day. And every time we see one of these divisive events, it's like, remember during the campaign when Trump had some kind of disagreement with Mexico, or somebody in Mexico spoke up against his idea of building the wall, and he said to some ravenous crowd, "Guess what, everybody? The wall just got 20 feet fucking higher," you know, and everyone erupted in cheers. It's like every one of these divisive current events has that effect of the wall between the echo chambers growing higher. What just happened in Las Vegas is immediately polarized into a gun issue, right? The time to grieve is like minutes. The time for humanity is so brief. And, you know, I don't know who's to blame, which side's more to blame. I mean, I saw the same things happening on InfoWars that I saw happening in, you know, Hillary Clinton's Twitter feed or on CNN. It's like immediately, how do we take this thing and mold it into political usefulness for us? And that happens again and again. But most people feel this kind of Manichaeanism that we've talked about so much on the show in the past. The insularity of the internet reinforces this. This is a battle for good and evil. This is a battle for social justice and equality, or this is a battle to save Western civilization. If you think about these divisions like that, it doesn't matter what's going on in the other side. That's not even part of the equation. So I think the left's attitude, or the left's general approach to the internet, has been like, this is a tool, going back to the lessons of 2008 and Obama, for political mobilization. Everything else is just a distraction, and people are actually engaging in a kind of form of disruption or aggression if they go into one of these political mobilization platforms and they say, "Hey, can we just kind of talk about what you guys are doing here?" I learned that lesson the hard way in 2011 with my first Facebook ban for being an abuser when I asked simple questions of the public sector union people in Wisconsin, like, "Hey, have you guys ever, you know, like maybe thought you should actually pay more into your pension?" There's no time for that. We're beyond that. It's like, our side is good, the other side is evil. This is our agenda. Are you here to forward it, or are you here to disrupt it? And if you're here to disrupt it, you are being abusive, right? That's where that mindset comes from. It's like, they were the first to harness this technology, and they believe that it primarily serves the function of achieving political ends.
I think that's why Donald Trump got elected, right? Like, something you and I, last time we did a podcast together, we talked about how Donald Trump played a specific game, just like Scott Adams says. He played a specific game. He played the game, "I'm going to win the Electoral College." And then there's a bunch of people, even like myself, who got in on the meme war because I thought it was funny. Like, I thought it was really funny. And then I was like, oh, man, all these people asked me if I had voted for Donald Trump. And then I told them I didn't vote. I was like, man, how many people did I actually convince to vote for Donald Trump by being an asshole? And it seemed like it was quite a bit. I mean, like, there's a lot of people that like John Oliver's Drumpf bit. And then I started just kind of trolling by reading Scott Adams' blog. And it was pretty entertaining to me. And it was like, to me, so I guess, like, so let's go back to producers versus consumer, right? So when I read that blog, I'm like, well, let's play a game and let's talk to an anti-Trump person and let's frame it the way Scott Adams did in his blog about how to hypnotize a anti-Trump supporter. And it was surprising what kind of, like, how heated people would get with me, how people would call me a racist if I said Mexico is a country, not a race, or just different things. And so I'm kind of like, I'm thinking about all this, and it's like, it's it's opportunistic for producers who make their money off of outrage to immediately take this into a gun debate. Like the tragedy. I mean, obviously, I have my own conspiratorial views. I've already said that previously in the podcast. Like, yeah, it's going to make sense. It's going to make financial sense for Alex Jones to create some meme that his listeners can share to feel some sort of moral superiority over the enemy who is wrong, who wants to take their guns away. Just like I saw, I mean, I kind of got suckered in and I tried to just say, I think all this debate is fucking stupid. Man, like a bunch of people just got shot. It's clear to me that we have a human problem, but instead we just want to politicize everything. Everything's in a lot of it, I think, is because people have skin in the game to keep it politicized. I mean, people make money off of it. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to come out and say that people are good or evil. I just think when people have the living that they make off of it, much like Nathan said, I mean, if people are feeding their families via this income that's derived from reaction or, you know, fast thinking and reactionary platforms like Facebook and everything else, why wouldn't they? I mean, especially if they weren't. I mean, look at Alex Jones's popularity, how much it's increased, how much more money he's probably making. And it's just because he's getting crazier and crazier. Like, I think it's kind of human nature. I mean, it's easy to think, I mean, yeah, maybe there is a plan to control people for money. When people have skin in the game, they're not going to want to lose status and where they are. They're going to want to stay relevant, which is why Hillary Clinton is still talking or wrote that god awful book she just wrote. So, I mean, that's kind of my perspective on this. I mean, I 100% agree. I think it's disgusting that people try to politicize this. And, you know, as somebody that is for freedom and gun freedom, like, yeah, it's super annoying to me when people are immediately trying to say, oh, we need to take away weapons. It's like, well, all those weapons were illegal. But then it's like, I feel like I'm guilty by participation. And then I'm also feeling like, just like you said, I have to have a side or I have to fight through the chaos. It's just kind of like something Jordan Peterson said, you know, honesty is your only weapon in times of chaos. And I think that's the biggest thing, is staying true to yourself. But I think so often with the echo chambers of the internet, I mean, I know I used to do this, is we look for somebody's opinion to take on that we trust instead of worrying about what we actually think, what we actually feel, or how this might actually affect ourselves.
Absolutely. You also used a phrase, human nature. And I think that, like, do human beings have a nature? I think is something that in many ways the answer is yes. But human nature becomes most apparent when people live unconsciously and non-introspectively, right? Like we've said on my show before, free will is something that you earn through living consciously. If you live unconsciously, you can very easily be puppeteered by emotional means. And, you know, Jay Dyer and I talked a lot about that in the last episode of my podcast. Nathan, I wanted to hear your comments on the same topic. And it's interesting. There's a couple of things I want to add and about your story. I remember a couple months ago, we were talking about a group you run called Free Market Squad. We were talking about some of the frustration because of debates that were driving people off topic inside the group. And I've obviously had the same frustrations with, you know, the school sucks group, as far as like, this takes us away from our mission. So it actually gives us, you know, an opportunity, reflecting on our own experience with our own platforms, some sympathy for the left and how they feel when people do this in their agenda driven platforms. But I also know that you had this kind of hard left, almost Marxist political beginning. And did you think the problem was just as bad then, as far as people being very agenda driven and that the hyper focus on some kind of political achievement occluded the possibility of debate or discussion or reflection about ideas?
So I guess there's a couple things to unpack there. Yeah. When it comes to my particular community that I run, it's not specifically like a political community. It's a business and marketing community. So it's geared towards free market individuals. And we've had situations where minor things, you know, the minarchist versus anarchist and statist versus anarchist, and you're a socialist because you agree with roads or military. For me particularly, it's like, look, there's 1,000 other Facebook groups that you can go debate that with. That's not the point of this. The point of this group is to build your business, to build your marketing infrastructure. All of that stuff is just a distraction. It's not that I don't want people talking about it. It's just that's not what this particular room of the house is for. This is the smoking room. If you want to go drink, go to the living room. Or if you want to watch TV, go to the entertainment room. It's not so much that I don't want people having those discussions. It's just that it's not productive to the goal of the group. And like you said, I came from a very, very far left. My dad was Reconquista and all about reclaiming the stolen land from, you know, for Mexico. And mm-hmm. I grew up worshiping people like Che Guevara, and I grew up totally indoctrinated in Marxist ideology. And the people that I grew up with, the Marxists that I grew up with, are not like these Antifa beta male college kids that wear tight skinny jeans and the most manly thing about them is they grew a beard one time. The Marxists that I grew up with were like actual, and I think that they're still out there, actual revolutionaries, like people that did own a lot of guns, people that did plot and were waiting for a physical confrontation and weren't just role-playing like a lot of these Antifa kids are. So right. My experience on the left is not all of the fears that the right-wingers have about the worst possible situation that could come from Antifa. That's what I grew up. That's the culture that I grew up in. But again, I'm all for discussion. I'm all for listening to those points of view. I'm about listening to the opposite points of view, because I wouldn't be in the position I'm in if I was only able to stay in the echo chamber that I grew up in. I'd probably be in prison, or I'd probably be dead, or I'd probably still be a loser waiting for a glorious revolution to be able to confiscate all of the property that I was, you know, owed by birthright. So I feel like, as much as countering opinions might enrage me, as much as countering opinions might be off-putting to me, I'm all for countering opinions to be able to exist and to be out there, because I know that I wouldn't have been able to achieve what I've achieved in my life if it wasn't for countering opinions being available for me to consume.
Absolutely. And the, you know, intellectual gymnasium they also provide, which I know was part of what you're saying and what we've said so many times before, the avoiding the parent who uses Purell all the time in the world of ideas. And I think it's almost abusive when I see these situations or I hear parents. There was this the one unschooling group that just really drove me crazy, and I didn't leave it, but I stopped interacting with people in it and seeing them as allies in the sort of government school versus educational freedom fight, because they were their own sort of authoritarians. I'm going to protect my children from these ideas. If you think ideas are toxic, there has to be some exposure to them for just that personal strengthening effect that it provides.
So just on that note, because I was always attracted to other people's ideas, and not just for like the point of debating them, but just because obviously I learn better from people that have different experiences. And being a marketer, you have to really understand empathy. You have to really understand how to get into another person's shoes and how to get into another person's point of view. But the effect of safeguarding from any kind of other ideas, it seems like nowadays the higher education system, where I figured, especially growing up, I was told that that's where you go to get other points of view. It seems like that has, you've railed on a lot about public education being kind of echo chamber. And now it seems like higher education has become an echo chamber. And now the people that have come out of that higher education are now trying to turn, not just for profitability and for marketing reasons, but because they're uncomfortable with other people's points of view. It seems like they're not able to allow that on the internet now. Channels on YouTube being pulled and demonetized and put on private mode, where none of their videos are viewable because they express something that a college kid had a negative triggering reaction to. I guess that's where my main fear and concern of all of this is I just remember how much the internet, through shows like School Sucks, through different podcasts, through different online courses that I was able to take, through YouTube videos where I was able to look and critique other points of view and learn from other people. I'm kind of concerned that we're going back the other way. And now that a lot of these people that are in the tech world come from that echo chamber reality where they've been protected from other points of view, I'm worried that they're going to start like they've done with a lot of the entertainment mediums, I'm worried that they're going to start doing that with the internet as a whole, where we're going to start seeing the equivalent of digital book burning that maybe seems like it's at the beginning stages, but I am concerned that it's going to expand past where it's at right now.
Sure. Drew?
I liked what Nathan was saying. I mean, one thing I did forget to mention was when it comes to like the echo chamber thinking, I mean, I feel like, you know, the internet's always been used by people with eating disorders, group viewing, or other mental illnesses to try to find other like-minded people to connect with so they don't feel so crazy. And I think a lot of times it's easy to get trapped in that, and it's easy to, and that's why I think it's healthy to just ask ourselves like a question and know, I don't want to say know thyself because it's kind of a outdone thing, but in a way, yeah, like know, like get a healthy, I think all of us have benefited from getting uncomfortable. And I think the dangers of not getting uncomfortable is you don't actually grow. And when you stop growing, you kind of start moving backwards. And I think that's a lot of what's going on the left and the right. And I think that's why that polarization is happening, because people don't want to have a conversation. People want to condemn you immediately instead of like just saying, you know what, let me be empathetic here and let me hear this person's perspective, because maybe I can learn something from this person's life experience or from an event that took place in this person's life. So maybe I have an understanding as to why they feel the way they feel or believe the things that they believe. So that's all I got on that.
I just want to say, as a business owner, as somebody who is a producer of content and of services and products, outside of the comfort zone is where all the magic in life happens. And this whole conversation that we've been talking about really boils down to, more and more and more people are refusing to go outside of their comfort zone, especially ideologically. And that, to me, is the most horrifying aspect of it, because, like I said, going outside of my comfort zone has led me to every single opportunity that I've been able to achieve in life. More and more, I see people just refusing, again, especially ideologically, refusing to go outside of their comfort zone. And that right there is just something that I don't think it's going to have very positive outcomes for society as a whole.
Oh, yeah. And we can see the results of that already. You know, a lot of the articles that I read about the topic of internet echo chambers, you know, they were talking about the problem as it existed in 2015. These articles were rewritten today. You're talking about a problem that's multiple times worse for that very reason. And in fact, a lot of people panicked and kind of hardened their positions. They raised those walls 20 feet higher and 20 feet higher and 20 feet higher because of this, whatever it is, desperation or fear or urgency. And I mean, it's understandable why people feel that way, especially if they don't have experience outside of their comfort zone. These things are really, really disruptive and disturbing. And it's happening on both sides. It does seem to be much more prevalent and theatrical on the left, for sure, but you know, the right is not immune to this either. And unfortunately, too many people with liberty philosophies are not immune to this. So I think that there's a nice segue there to wrap up the conversation. Speaking of comfort zones, gosh, guys, for the last, and I know the three of us are going to talk about this in private tonight, but I have been outside of mine, certainly for the last 3 weeks or so, preparing for this trip, which is 40 days of being outside my comfort zone, driving across the country. And that's pretty much the number one reason why I'm doing this, is exactly because it is a challenge that I need at this point in my life. It is a logistical nightmare as far as planning is concerned. It's going to be very, very expensive. It is going to really challenge my introvert nature to be around strangers and interacting with strangers day after day after day after day. But it's something that I know I need to do, and there's a tremendous growth opportunity. And the ultimate destination is Los Angeles, California on November 10th. I'm going to see Drew in Columbus, Ohio.
That's right.
About 10 days into the trip, we're going to do a small event there, a little reunion from the Salem event, actually, with Alex Bell and Daniel McCarthy, who were two attendees who really moved me and Thad with their story. So I'm looking forward to getting both of those guys on the record if possible. A lot of people have reached out to me, Drew, like a preschool teacher who discovered the show. One of the campus coordinators for Students for Liberty wants to come and do an interview. So like Columbus is probably going to be the second biggest event aside from a weekend with Thaddeus Russell. I'm also going to go to Colorado, so there's a good chance I might see Nathan while I'm there, and probably organizing a smaller event in the Denver Boulder area. But yeah, what are we going to do when we get out to California? Nathan, you're native to that area. What adventures should we plan outside of the event?
Well, we're going to be in LA, so just try and avoid drive-bys, I suspect.
It's not that bad.
It's not. LA is not nearly as bad as it was back in the 80s. So I'm just looking forward to the opportunity to meet with you, meet with the other people, meet Thad. Because, again, listening to your podcasts with Thad over the years and watching his evolution, watching your evolution, watching it overlap with some of my own evolutions, I just think this is going to be a really great experience getting to, it's been a year since I've been able to chill with Drew. We're getting an Airbnb together and, we're going to be hanging out and
renting a car.
I think it's just going to be a good time. It's a little bit outside of my comfort zone just because I'm kind of like one of those extroverted introverts. I don't really like being in the audience. I like being on the stage. So to be in the audience is going to be a little bit, different for me. And, I felt like I robbed myself by not attending the first event. So, when you mentioned that you were doing the second one, I didn't hesitate to go buy tickets for it. So I'm just looking forward to it. It's going to be a great experience, a bunch of great people meeting you, getting together again with Drew, meeting David Garfinkel in real life, meeting Thad is going to be awesome. And I'm grateful I was able to get one of the VIP tickets before they sold out.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I did want to make the decision. There is an important, if you people can only obtain the regular tickets, it's not like people are segregated in any way. The VIPs just get an extra day. But once Saturday came, everybody's all together. Everybody has the same opportunities from that point on. And there's still plenty of opportunities left for people to get those tickets. I know that there's a lot of people in the School Sucks community and the Complete Liberty community down in San Diego. And I know they're listening, so I hope they'd be willing to make the 2+ hour trip up to LA to attend this event and hang out with us as well. And a lot gets packed into the Saturday and the Sunday of this event. Drew, are you looking to do anything touristy while you're in LA? Have you ever been? You've been there, right?
Yeah, I've been to LA. I'm going to link up with a couple comic friends, hopefully. But no, man, I'm not a tourist. I would rather... I mean, I feel like whatever we all decide to do together, that's what it's about. I think I'm just, it's going to sound cheesy, but I'm a man of community. And I think that coming together and fellowshipping in person, conversations you're having, getting to know people outside of the comments that you like on Facebook or anything, it's always rewarding. I mean, like in preparation for you coming here, I've had a couple conversations with both Daniel and Alex, and Alex has come over a few times. Me and Alex have become pretty decent friends, and I just think it's making more friendships. I think that there's most of my friends now I've met via the internet, either through different communities I've been a part of, but it's usually just trying to find other people that are like-minded and have similar interests, because usually you find weird interests that you never would have thought they'd have. And yeah. I think that's the most exciting thing, man. I think I don't really think it matters what we decide to do. I think, it looked like everybody was pretty tight knit. I think some of my favorite pictures from the first event are just people sitting around engaged in it looks like productive conversation. You know, teamwork makes the dream work, guys.
Yep, absolutely. Well said. I agree with just about everything you said. I have very similar goals. I also need to get a black Raiders jacket while I'm there. And Raiders hat. My new wardrobe. I'm super excited for, of course, the trip and that weekend sort of being the pinnacle of that trip. I really appreciate you guys coming on the show. We'll be masterminding together tonight, and we'll be talking about the same subject because I need help with certain aspects of the trip. So I look forward to that. That's always a highlight of my week as well, to do the mastermind group. I wanted you guys to just have a chance to plug your shows and sites before I let you go. Drew, you want to go first?
Yes, I'm the host of The Sample Hour, or just samplehour.com. I'm hosted on Podcast Blast Off, which is Nathan's service. Yeah, looking forward to bringing in more episodes. Hopefully Brett and I can do some live episodes. I'm sure we will when you see me in Columbus.
Yeah.
So yeah, looking forward to bringing more podcasts with you guys, with Brett, and showing Brett the city. I'm also, so if you guys are in Columbus, I'm also an urban farmer. So just feel free to contact me if you guys want to come see the farm. I'm pretty proud. I'm making a living on a 15th of an acre, and I've done a lot of out of the box thinking to make my lifestyle work. So I'm feeling proud of myself. So I need to learn to shamelessly self promote a little bit better.
Indeed, yeah.
Nathan's turn.
All right. Well, first of all, thanks for inviting me on, Brett. This was an awesome conversation. I'm glad to be a part of it.
My pleasure.
You can check out my podcast over at NathanFraserShow.com. And then I'm just going to plug two other things real quick. If you're looking to start a podcast, if you want to engage in the free speech of the internet while it's still available and you want to start a podcast and get your message out there, I have a lot of tools available over at podcastblastoff.com to help you do that. And if you're a business owner and you're looking to improve your marketing, improve your sales copy, you can check out freemarketsquad.com. And I've got a bunch of information over there to help people get better return on their advertising dollars. So podcastblastoff.com and freemarketsquad.com are my two businesses. And then NathanFraserShow.com is my podcast.
Awesome. And what's the podcast you do with David Garfinkel? And I wanted you to mention that because I had actually worked as an advisor on the production of his audiobook for his breakthrough copywriting book that he wrote. And I learned a lot just from going through the book. And I know there's a podcast related to a lot of the topics that he covers in the book that you're a part of. So what is that?
Yeah. So each week, me and David get together and we do an episode of the Copywriters Podcast. And that's just all about writing better advertisements. David is renowned, worldwide known as the world's greatest copywriting coach. He's the very first person to actually template and formulate the copywriting process. And he gets paid buco dollars by GKIC and by Agora Financial, and a bunch of other people come to him just to do copy critiques. Easily one of the top 10 copywriters in the world. His ads just convert like nothing else. And each week he just lays out in depth all the different aspects of copywriting. And the thing that I feel so grateful for doing the podcast with him is I've spent tens of thousands of dollars on courses on marketing and on copywriting courses. And the stuff that he gives away for free in that podcast each week far outvalue the things that I've spent tens of thousands of dollars on. Mm. So if you're looking to write better advertisement, or if you're just looking to sell your own ideas better, the Copywriters Podcast is definitely hands down the number one source or number one resource for that.
Excellent. Awesome, guys. So I'll talk to you both tonight. And then Drew, I'll see you in a few weeks. Nathan, I'll see you one more week after that. And then the three of us will be together in November.
Sweet. Thanks again for having us on, Brett.
Yeah, Brett. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
From sadness to exhilaration, like a robot at your command. My hands perspire and shake like a leaf up, and down goes my temperature. I summon doctors to get some relief, but they tell me there is no cure. They tell me no way to control.
everyone. Thanks for sticking around. First thing, there was some articles that I wanted to incorporate in this show, and I didn't get the chance to pause the three-person conversation and work them in. So if you heard me mention like a study or an article, check the show notes. That stuff is there. Folks, I got to tell you, this trip, like I'll be sitting at my desk and planning it, and then suddenly I'm just so excited that I'm up and running around the house screaming. Do you ever do that, or do you not secretly have Tourette's, like I do, apparently? I just could not be more pumped up about this, and just wanted to tell you a little bit. The updates will be coming along the way, for sure. It's about 9 days. Today is October 6th, so I'm leaving in 9 days. But I just want to tell you a little bit about the first week of the trip and some of the larger details here. Before I do that, I want to say thank you to everyone who has made a donation. A few people have made financial donations. A few people, three people, have made purchases off the Amazon wish list. A listener named Beth bought me an Amazon gift card that I'm going to use to buy a suitcase, a new stylish suitcase. I have a great suitcase, and the zipper broke on the pocket where I like to keep my toiletries. So that could be real embarrassing. If that's just wide open. Thank you to Beth for that. Thanks to Larry Sherman and Nick Ulbrich for buying things off the Amazon wish list. Nick, you remember. Actually, both of those names are going to factor into the trip, so I'll tell you more about that in the near future. One package came without... Only three people made purchases off the Amazon wish list, and one package came without the slip. So I'm missing a person that needs to be thanked. All of the people who made financial contributions, I think at this point I have thanked them individually. And I really just appreciate all of the enthusiasm. I think somewhere in the neighborhood of about 150 requests to go to certain places. Fortunately, some of those people were in the same place. So we will be doing events as we go out, or as I go out to Los Angeles, in the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania area, Columbus, Ohio, which you heard about on the show today, Detroit, I'm really excited about that one, and somewhere in the Denver, Boulder, Colorado area. Then the event will be in November. I don't have any large meetups scheduled on the way back, but I'm going to be swinging through the South, and I'll tell you more about that soon. But just so you can get a sense of what's going on here, I'll tell you a little bit about the first week of the trip. So I'm leaving the New Hampshire Seacoast area on Sunday the 15th. I'm going to Keene to launch out of New Hampshire from there. I'll be on Free Talk Live that night. My first stop, very important first stop, in Hartford, Connecticut, to do a show with Richard Grove. Then I'll be in Philadelphia for 2 days. I'm going to be staying with a listener named Phil, who attended the Salem event. After Philadelphia, I'm going to be headed to York, Pennsylvania, to see old friend Mandrick. You might remember Mandrick. He was a live show co-host. He also had a company called George's Famous Baklava. And Tony Myers, who I haven't done a face-to-face in-person show with since 2013. I'm going to make a quick stop in Harrisburg to see a school. More on that. And then by the end of the first week, I'll be in Pittsburgh, where I'm hoping to connect with Zach Slaybeck. My friend Andrew, who you might know from Puke in the Gang, is also from Pittsburgh. So he is going to drive out and meet me there. And he is going to be kind of a tour guide of that very, very cool city. And it's not just the sights. It's the people and how they talk. I'm going to get to hear people call rubber bands gum bands. In the second week, I'm on into Ohio. By the end of the second week, I am in Kansas City, Missouri. I was really surprised how many people were in Kansas City and wanted to meet up. So I added an extra day in Kansas City. By the end of the third week, I'll be either in Reno or Sacramento or somewhere in between. And by the end of the fourth week, that is a weekend with Thaddeus Russell. I'm still really working hard to plan the return trip. It has to be done in 11 days. Well, the outbound trip is like 25 days. So I'm really trying to be more strategic about the return trip. And there's things that I really want to do on the return trip. So But I'll be talking more about you know, why the return trip is rushed and some extra details about it in the very near future. So at this point, I can't really take any more requests for meetups, and I need to kind of space the meetups out as I am kind of an introvert. So there are, you know, individuals that I want to meet with along the way. I want to hear their stories. And, you know, if this is a success, I'll gladly do it again. I found out there was a lot of people up in Minnesota, and I just can't make it up there. It's too far out of the way. But I would certainly talk with them. I actually started a little email chain about going out there specifically to do an event. I talked to somebody else about doing the same thing in New York City, which is a place I won't be able to spend a lot of time on this trip. I'll swing through there, I think. But, you know, it's only about 5 hours from where I live, so I'd certainly go back. I'm going to be well-traveled after this, and I will learn a lot on the road. So I might consider doing more smaller trips like this in the future. Yeah, I made a shitload of purchases for this. I had to get a new laptop. I had to get some new audio equipment. I've spent a lot of money on the car, but I'm super excited about doing this. It is going to be a great adventure, and I look forward to meeting some of you along the way and reporting back to all of you on how it goes, the stories I hear, the connections I make. You should be following me on Instagram. You can just search my name, or I think you can search School Sucks Project, and you'll find me there. My Instagram is really delightful. If you are not following me yet, you should go and follow, and just give yourself a half an hour to go through some of my posts, and I think you'll have a good time. So the final thing, the fundraising call at the beginning of the show, at the end of every quarter, so at the end of September, I do the accounting for how much money is going out and how much money is coming in related to the show. And we got creamed between July and September. The Patreon thing has been slowly but steadily going up, and that's great. But there's a lot of uncertainty with Patreon. People can, you know, deny payments. Payments can fail just like they fail with PayPal. But the AV Club, we lost in the third quarter like hundreds of dollars a month in either cancellations or suspensions. And I sent out an email to like, I think 60 different people who had their payments suspended. And I heard back, I think, from two or three of them. So unfortunately, when, you know, whatever it is, a bank issue, a debit card issue, a PayPal account issue, when that suspension happens, that's pretty much it. It's a really hard problem to resolve. And it's really unfortunate because we lose a lot of people that way. So if you want to support the show, both of those options, the Patreon option, patreon.com/schoolsucks, or the AV Club option, which gives you access to like hundreds and hundreds of hours of bonus content going all the way back to 2010, that's schoolsucksproject.com/AV. When I did this accounting, my first thought was this trip doesn't make any sense with these revelations, but I have money saved that I can spend, and you know, I'm out to have a life experience here and really get out of a comfort zone and, you know, make that getting out of the comfort zone public. So regardless of I mean, it's not like a super stupid decision to go financially, but ooh, I was just a little apprehensive after looking at the books. So, of course, if you can help us out, that would be appreciated. And to all the people who've been supporting us for so long, thank you so much. You really made this adventure possible, and I am extremely grateful. Not just that you listen to the show, but that you find it worth supporting. It really means a lot to me. It is a great kind of feedback. So there's still so many emails I haven't even gotten back to, and I really need to like try to crank through them this weekend. And thanks, of course, to anyone I forgot who found, you know, a creative way to support this trip. The fact that you're excited about it makes me even more excited about it. So the 15th can't come soon enough. I'm excited to get on the road and see what this is like. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. More updates coming soon. I hope you have a good weekend.